This is Caught in the Act with Tim Clark.
Welcome back. The name dripped with glamour and wealth and glitz and fame. Versace. But the reality was a lot grimier than the Italian fashion house which made it famous.
Police are investigating possible bikie links to a suspected murder in Nangara after a man in his 30s was shot dead yesterday afternoon.
Joseph Rodney Versace. Shot in the head, dead, in a shed north of Perth. The gunman, clad in black and wearing a mask, made his escape in a black BMW with the number plate 666. And he stayed on the run for days until police put out his face and his car and his name, Joshua Duperuzel. Within 2 hours, that distinctive face, bald, tattooed and slightly menacing, stopped a lady in a park in Belmont to ask her something, whether he could have a bite of his sandwich. She didn't really feel like she could say no, so she gave him the bite and watched him eat it, before watching a swathe of heavily armed police swoop and scoop up Josh Duperuzel for the murder of Joe Versace. Joining us to break down the case of the state of Western Australia versus Joshua Colin Duperuzel is Cyan Valance, the court reporter for 7 News Perth, who covered this case alongside me for several years, ending this week. Cy, thanks for joining us on Caught in the Act.
Thanks for having me, Tim. This is one of those cases that I think will probably stay with us for the rest of our careers.
Yes, because of various aspects which we're going to go through in the next 40 minutes or so. The context and background of the shootings, or that shooting in September 22, was that tensions were still high following the sniper-style execution of Nick Martin, the rebels' boss. Police had cracked down even harder on all the MCG gangs around Perth. And then, as we said, a man turns up dead with a bullet in him in a Nangara garage. Gang crime squad are called and they're everywhere investigating. And then, I mean, senior rebels bikies are seen at the scene. It was a sort of made for TV and made for tabloid sort of scenario right from the get-go.
It was, and it came out of, because of Nick Martin's assassination, this really just tense time. Like, I haven't seen anything like it, I suppose, since the 90s in Perth, where there was sort of a series of bikie shootings. But it seemed to just be triggered by that assassination, then this murder. And as you said, there were a bunch of bikies who turned up at the scene that night at the workshop of a known common sharer, Kiefer Wallace. Yeah. Of course, the most high profile appearance that day was Joseph Raimondi, one of the rebels, rumoured to be Nick Martin's best friend. And he was actually arrested, nothing to do with the murder, but for showing off his rebels and 1% tattoo. Of course, that's illegal in Western Australia, displaying in Sydney. So didn't turn out very well for him that
night.
Yeah.
And this is all within sort of 12 hours of this, yeah, this man being shot dead. And at this point, all we know is basically that a man is dead, called Versace, there are bikies on the scene, and there are gang crime squad members everywhere. So obviously it set the hounds running from newsrooms all over the state, but also sort of, you know, online sleuths were also were in their element as well.
Absolutely. Yeah, everyone had something to say. It's one of those things, you know, it was only recently we found out exactly what happened, but the speculation, I think especially online, was just going rampant.
Yeah. So Joey Versace was a son, a brother, a father, a friend to many, but he was also involved in drugs. According to a family disclosure in 2007, Versace had been involved in a life-altering motorcycle accident, which may well have killed him, but it didn't, thanks to life-saving medical intervention. But it did leave him changed and damaged. On a GoFundMe page, Joey's sister Connie said that since the accident, he'd struggled to cope with the side effects of a near-death experience. She said From that time, he became addicted to drugs and had been in and out of jail. Those charges included possession of a prohibited weapon, possession of prohibited drug with intent to sell a supply, aggravated burglary and stealing. His sister said Joey's young daughter was struggling with having a father in and out of jail. And the reason she was bearing all on a GoFundMe page, to ask for help to get Mr. Versace into rehab. That appeal was largely unsuccessful, in monetary terms at least. And it would appear so were the attempts for Mr. Versace to get completely clean. Because as of September 2022, Joey Versace was still involved in drugs and some of the people surrounding that crooked career. Cyan, in court reporting, you and I and others often have to navigate the sort of light and dark of people when reporting on them, because in most cases there is a bit of both. And in Joey Versace's case, that was particularly true, because he undoubtedly had his faults and his troubles with drugs. But as we've just said, and we have seen since his murder, he also had very loyal friends and a lot of very close family.
And watching that family after the sentencing, like, it was just heartbreaking. His sister was almost physically sick. You can see the grief has just had this tremendous impact on that family. And it doesn't matter what anyone's been involved with. Nobody deserves to be shot in the head. Like, it's just horrific. And his mum, his sister, his daughter, who now has to face, she's only 14, but she's going to grow up without a dad. That's a tragedy for that family. And you're right, when it comes to court reporting, you do have to navigate the light and dark. And I don't know about you, but a lot of the time, you know, you see people in the dock and you think, wow, like, this one sliding doors moment has changed everything for you forever. You know, people like to believe in heroes and villains. That's simply not true. There are only people. And that's what we see in the dock.
And it is treading a fine line, because obviously, in this case in particular, the man who ended up dead was in a lifestyle that put him more at risk than others, shall we say. But he also, as we said, had a daughter, and particularly his mum and particularly his sister. Sometimes the secondary victims, as they're referred to in court, don't want anything to do with the media. But in this case, they were up front and they did want to talk about their son and their brother. For a variety of reasons, which, provides then another layer on top of the story that you have to treat with respect, but also have to treat like a news item as well, and you know, pick the best things out of it that you think are most relevant to the story.
Yeah, exactly. And one of the things that they came out and said, it was literally days after the murder, is they wanted to make it clear that they say Joe Versace had absolutely nothing to do with the bikies. He was not a bikie. And they were very upset by those inferences that he was. And then they went on to say, like, his mum has said numerous times, he was a beautiful person. And this is her son. And to her, he was a beautiful son. And that is what we report, that, you know, for all... Yeah, there are sort of these nuances. And of course, like you said, he was involved in this lifestyle and maybe that put him more at risk. But there's absolutely no point in victim blaming when he's dead and his family is grieving like that. So it is, like you said, walking the fine line, but also being so respectful to the fact that this was a human being and he lived this full life and his family is going to be changed forever.
Well, it was on September 29th, 2022. Quite late in that day when news began filtering through about a shooting at a property up in Nangarra. Nangarra, semi-rural, semi-industrial, it's part of Perth on the fringes, sort of bigger blocks out of the way where some stuff you might not want the world to see can take place. Back in 2000, for example, a chap by the name of Antonius Peter Chick, nicknamed TC, was a mechanic working out of his workshop and living in Nangarra. Also in Nangarra, when police came knocking, were a smorgasbord of hard drugs, including meth, LSD, amphetamines and cannabis. Chick's explanation as to why they were there was that a gang of seven or so very unpleasant characters who looked like bikies turned up at his workshop one day and demanded to be given a motorcycle. Then he was lured to a phony breakdown, assaulted by a similar group, he said, and handed a mobile phone. And then an unknown caller told him to pick up and hide a big blue bag, which was full of narcotics. Chick said he knew he was in trouble if he didn't do what he was told. He was in even more trouble when a court didn't believe that story, instead labelling him a middle to large scale drug dealer and handed him an 11-year jail sentence. Chick's Nangara property, the property where all his drugs were found, was on Sydney Road. And it was that very same property, still being used as a mechanical workshop, that Joe Versace was at on that September day when a black BMW pulled up. Inside that car was a man dressed all in black, complete with mask. His name was Josh Duperuzel, and the Luger 9mm pistol he was carrying was a dead giveaway that he wasn't there just to get his car fixed. Cyan, for the first time this week, we found out in detail what happened when Josh Duperuzel turned up at Sydney.
Yes, Tim, and just before. So we know from the statement of facts that about 10 minutes before he turned up there, he actually turned off his mobile phone so he couldn't be traced. And then at about 3:56 p.m. that day, he pulled up at a spot around 2 kilometres away, opened the boot of his car, put some black trousers on over his shorts and some black gloves on. And he was holding some black material, which is understood to be a mask. He then got back into his car, drove to the workshop, pulled up and got out with his face covered. Now, it wasn't just Mr. Versace there that day. There were five other people, four men on the ground floor of the workshop, and Mr. Versace was upstairs on the mezzanine. Duperuzel turned up, face covered, holding a gun. I can't imagine how terrifying it would be to be confronted by that. And he's demanded from these four men to know where Mr. Versace is. They've told him at gunpoint that he's on the mezzanine level, so that's where Duperuzel has gone. There was all this speculation about how many times he'd been shot and what happened, but this is the facts of what everyone agrees did happen. Joshua Duperuzel went upstairs and confronted Mr. Versace. Mr. Versace was standing with meth in hand and cash on the floor. There was an argument, verbal, yelling at each other. At some point, Duperuzel said, "Put it in the bag, put it all in the bag." And in amongst the yelling and the fighting, he fired three shots into the mezzanine floor. Now, somewhere along there, the fight became physical and Duperuzel pulled the trigger. The bullet went through Versace's right eye and exited just behind his left ear. Which you hear that and you think, he just would never have stood a chance. Duperuzel grabbed an unknown amount of cash and he fled. Now, the people downstairs, three out of four of them had already fled because they heard the gunshots and ran. One of those people called emergency services. They turned up, but at 4:11, Joe Versace was declared dead. And so from Duperuzel pulling up and changing into that black outfit and Mr. Versace being declared dead, that all happened in the space of 15 minutes. It's really unbelievable to think.
Yeah. And, we've touched on it before, from there, it doesn't take long for the jungle drums to start beating. And certainly the West Australian had a photographer there within hours and captured sort of quite dramatic pictures of the scene, of family members turning up, of other rebels being there. And for whatever reason, the light on that night it shed red, so the front page the next day was quite dramatic and actually also quite symptomatic of what had happened inside that shed, even though we didn't know at the time.
Absolutely. And I think, like you said, it was quite dramatic, but that is literally the nature of what happened. Like the lighting, the forensics, it was just a scene. Like, it did look like it was out of a movie. I hate to make that comparison, but that is how dramatic it was. It just had murder, gangs, everything about it. And it was so shocking to happen on the outskirts of Perth just after another bikie assassination.
And as Cyan said, it did come in the wake of the sniper-style assassination of Rebels boss Nick Martin. So the news of another targeted lethal shooting in Perth was met with equal parts fear and fury. Fear that it could spark even more gang-related mayhem, and fury that it could happen again, even with all the efforts of police and politicians to show WA's bikie gangs the door out of the state or into a prison. The presence of senior rebel Joe Raimondi at the crime scene, seemingly comforting members of Mr. Versace's family, was a clear sign that
the gang crime squad will be paying you a visit very shortly.
And so they were, bashing down doors and executing warrants all over the city within days.
In WA Police, we've been very clear on our response to this.
WA's top cop, Cole Blanche, labelled Versace's execution as a cold-blooded killing. Premier Mark McGowan said such violence just would not be tolerated. And Mr. Raimondi even got a summons for displaying his bikie insignia, i.e. his prominent Rebels tattoos, when he was filmed and pictured outside the Nangara crime scene. But the initial reports that Mr. Versace was directly affiliated or linked with a bikie gang himself were immediately and strongly denied by his grieving family. It had been said that he was muscle for a gang, doing the jobs other members didn't want to do. His sister Connie did admit he was no angel, but she insisted he was no Hell's Angel or no other type of bikie either. Cyan, Connie Versace gave this interview on 7 News, and I think it's an excellent example of how so-called gangland killings become sort of wrapped up in a mythology which can obscure or paint over the actual human cost of such violence, because you saw not a bikie widow or, you know, a bikie affiliated. All you saw on that interview on that night that Emily Baker did was just a grieving sister.
Yeah, and that's exactly what she was. And I think, you know, when you call it cold-blooded murder, gangland killing, bikie links, like, it can dehumanize the victim. Mm. Because, as we've said, as Connie said, her brother was no angel, but he was also a person with a full life and a family. And you're right, like, the human cost of this crime was enormous. But when you do only refer to, you know, the bikies, the gangland, you know, there is that mythology, especially in Western Australia after Nick Martin's assassination, or in Victoria with all of their sort of gangland murders. This is not a drama on television. This is real life. These are real people. And this was a real man who was murdered. And I just, I'm always very conscious of that in reporting, that, you know, this is not a story. These are people's lives. And, you know, you've got to try to communicate that. And I think Emily did a really good job of that in her story that night.
And then on the other side, you've got footage of TRG raids, bloke with tattoos being arrested and charges, and then grabs from police commissioners and, you know, other, you know, senior heads of state or certainly senior politicians, just saying how outrageous it is. And which, you know, from a TV news point of view, Anna, from a printed news point of view, you have to report as well. So you just said it's not a TV drama, but there is drama on TV that follows from a crime like this.
Absolutely. And there has to be. I think the thing is, like, both things can be true. People were so keen to see things in black and white, and it's just so rare that that ever happens. So, yes, you have to report the human cost. And talking to his family, I think it was really courageous of them to speak, especially so soon after their loss. But I think, like, the facts were there were all those raids. You know, Joe Raimondi was arrested for displaying insignia. These things are all true. And the challenge is to tell that story correctly and make sure that you're sort of honestly communicating those nuances to the audience.
Yeah.
It's, as you know, very difficult.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's certainly hard in a 2.5 minute TV package, and it can be hard as well. I always feel in print you get a little bit more space to maybe inject some of that nuance. But, you know, even in 400, 500 words or whatever it is, it's still hard to get everything in. And, you know, the cardinal sin in any journalism is burying the lead. And if you've got gang crime, you've got bikies, you've got a guy shot, and, you know, you've got community outrage, then that all has to go up the top.
Somewhat. You can't ignore that, of course. Yeah, definitely, especially in this case and especially in that context. Yeah.
So the intense manhunt for the shooter, the killer of Joe Versace, continued for days. One man, Joshua Finch, was hunted down and taken into custody, accused of hurtling down the freeway and then disposing of a bag of guns, allegedly given to him in the days after the shooting. And then, 5 days after Mr. Versace's last day on Earth, police made an urgent and very obvious appeal.
Detectives are searching for 25-year-old Joshua Duperrouzel and the movements of this BMW. Here's what they had to say a short time ago.
Mr. Duperrouzel is fair-skinned. He's 186 centimetres tall. He's of medium build. He has a shaved head and green eyes. Anyone who sees Mr. Duperrouzel, we ask that you contact Crime Stoppers and let us know. We also say a personal appeal to Mr. Duperrouzel that if you're watching this, to please make yourself known to the police. You can hand yourself into a police station or let us know where you are so that we can have a conversation with you.
Joshua Colin Duperrouzel was the man they wanted. They had his picture, they had his car, and they also had his history, although they weren't sharing all that just yet. And police knew he also had a nominee membership for the Rebels bikie gang, which wasn't hard to find, given photos of him in colours and with members were plastered all over his social media feeds. Within 2 hours of that police appeal being made, Josh Duperrouzel proved that he wasn't too hard to find either. In a bizarre turn of events in a park in Belmont, Duperrouzel approached a woman and asked her if he could have her sandwich. He told her he was wanted by police and that he wanted to hand himself in. He then got her to call police, who arrived within minutes and arrested the Duperrouzel without incident or gunfire. He had already eaten the sandwich by the time they got there. Cyan, I remember this was one of those news days that starts big with an appeal. And you get the picture, and you get the picture of the Beamer, and, you know, all the grabs from the senior police. And then it gets even bigger because it starts filtering through that not only do they know the man they want, but they've got him in custody within hours.
And it's so bizarre. Can we just for one moment imagine being that woman? You're in your lunch break, you're in a Belmont park, you've got the river in front of you, green trees, lovely. A man approaches you, big guy, face tattoos, mm-hmm. asks for your sandwich, says the police want him, or by the way, can you give him a call for me? How terrifying would that be?
Well, yeah, it would be bizarre. It would be surreal. You'd be looking around to see if you were being pranked, I reckon. Not that that's a thing. Does anyone get punked anymore these days? I don't know. But you'd be certainly thinking, is someone playing a trick on me? And then the chap, you know, takes your cheese and pickle and goes and sits down on the bench. And then you ring the police to say, excuse me. This chap's just said you're maybe looking for him. He's sort of, you know, 6'2", blue eyes, 178, got tattoos on the side of the head, and then all hell breaks loose. And he's just...
And police...
And he's still sitting there, yeah.
Finishes the sandwich. It's absolutely bizarre. And I can imagine for her afterwards when she found out who this was, oh my gosh, you would feel physically sick. But the police were there within minutes. And the whole arrest was caught on camera. Mm. You can see them sort of swarming the park, taking him down, and then taking him away. Like you said, this all happened within one day. I do remember in the newsroom, it was like, this has happened, this has happened, this has happened. And getting your head around it was just so much because suddenly it's just one thing after another. And police suddenly had their man. Yeah.
And Ben, you as TV journalists, you're praying for the footage. Please, someone must have seen something. Please, someone must have held up their phone. And in this case, they did. And as you say, it was pretty clear footage. And you could see what struck me was just the amount of police. Like they were not going to take any risks in subduing this chap who they obviously wanted for a very violent crime. And they had warned in the morning he might still be armed, because at this point they still didn't know where the gun was.
Exactly. And there were, I mean, you can see the footage, like you said, it's clear, but you can tell that whoever shot it, it's zoomed in a lot. You would stay far away, which they did, just police coming from every direction. Turns out he didn't have the murder weapon. That has never been found. He said he's forgotten what he's done with it. But yeah, they pulled out all the stops because at the time, just the highest alert.
Yeah. And then the following day after the arrest, Duperrouzel appeared in court for the first time, and there was a denial from him of sorts when his background and associations were mentioned in court.
Yes, a denial of sorts. That's a good way to put it. So he did speak up to tell the magistrate that the rebels had nothing to do with this case, the rebel biking gang, which, as you said, we understand that he was a nominee. He said this was a personal issue. That was at the very, very beginning. And we have since found out, in sentencing, that yes, he was a debt collector for the Rebels Biker Gang, but he also had, for want of a better word, like a side hustle where he was selling drugs sort of for himself. And that was, he is claiming, the personal issue that he was settling in this situation.
Eventually, Josh Duperrouzel made a formal denial of the charge of murder against him in court. But in the background, he'd made some admissions to police during that very first interview after that arrest in that Belmont Park. He told the police he'd had some dramas with Mr. Versace and he wanted to sort them out. That drama, Duperrouzel said, was a $3,000 drug debt. He wanted his money and he was ready to fight for it. But he took a gun with him to Nangara just in case Versace was armed himself. But he said he had never any intention of using it. It was after that interview that the formal murder charge came. And not long after that came Mr. Versace's funeral, complete with the Italian fashion house insignia emblazoned on the coffin of the father of one. Then came a plea of not guilty by Mr. Duperrouzel, and then in October last year, after some out-of-court negotiations, came a change of heart.
He was charged with murder, but always denied it until today. Duperrouzel has been in custody since his arrest and was set to stand trial in the Supreme Court next month. Instead, he pleaded guilty this morning, admitting he murdered Joseph Versace.
That guilty plea by Josh Duperrouzel was witnessed in court by Mr. Versace's mother, Marianne, who again admitted her son was no angel, but insisted he was no bikey either. Which led up to this week and the sentencing hearing of Josh Duperrouzel in WA's Supreme Court. And Cyan, as you've mentioned, for the first time we learned the quite gruesome details of Mr. Versace's murder, in particular, how he actually died.
Yes, and I think it's important to point out that in his interviews with police, Duperrouzel said he was worried that Joe Versace might be armed. He was completely unarmed. He was defenceless. Mm-hmm. Duperrouzel said he didn't mean to use the gun, but it was loaded. He'd already shot the fool three times before he then shot the father of one, as we said, through the right eye, and it was close range because it came out again behind his left ear. So by the time paramedics arrived within minutes, there was just absolutely nothing they could do for him. At the time, there was speculation he was shot twice in the chest, in the arm. In the end, it was as the result of a struggle, one gunshot wound to the head, and Mr. Versace just never stood a chance.
Yeah. And we also heard again, this time from senior prosecutor Justin Whalley in court, that there was no evidence or no formal link between Joe Versace and any bikie gang. and that the state accepted that the shooting was a personal beef between the two men, or certainly on behalf of Du Peruzzle, who claimed this debt that was owed to him.
Exactly. Like we said, his own little side hustle drug dealing business, he claims that Mr. Versace owed him that $3,000. That's never been substantiated in court. No. And at the end of the day, the Supreme Court justice said that that's irrelevant. Like, that doesn't actually matter. He doesn't have to make a finding either way, because it doesn't matter what anyone owes you. You don't find them in a garage and shoot them. Like, that's just, you know, and that is the crime that was being decided. But yeah, so what Du Peruzzle said in his first hearings about the rebels having nothing to do with it sound to be correct. This was a personal issue, and he was his intention of going there that day was to rob Mr. Versace, and he did, because he took that cash, but he also murdered a much-loved father, brother, and son.
So, when is a bikie shooting not a bikie shooting? Was this a bikie shooting, or just a senseless shooting carried out by a nominee bikie? In the end, as Cyan's just said, it didn't really matter to Justice Anthony Derrick, because he could only sentence on the facts given to him. And he summed them up this way. On your own admission, you were, at the time of the offence, operating as a debt collector for the gang. However, you were also engaged in selling drugs on your own behalf, independently of your connection with the gang. You told the pre-sentence report writer that you have recently, while in prison, become a member of the gang. You also told the pre-sentence report writer that you enjoy the camaraderie, inclusiveness, and loyalty that the gang provides you with. But the state does not allege that you attended the property with the intention of killing Mr. Versace or with the intention of causing him a life-threatening injury. Nor does the state allege that at the time you discharged the gun, you intended to kill Mr. Versace or intended to cause him a life-threatening injury. The state does not allege that you knew that the gun was pointed at Mr. Versace's head when you discharged it. Acceptance, ultimately on both sides, that while Du Peruzzle planned that robbery that day, he took a mask, he took a loaded gun, and he fired the fatal shot. He had not intended to kill Joe Versace, but he had killed while robbing him, which still made him guilty of murder and worthy of a life sentence. With time already served, cooperation with police, a guilty plea, and all the other sprinkles, Josh Du Peruzzle will have to serve a minimum of 14 years behind bars. Cyan, after that hearing, we again got to hear from Joe Versace's family. What were your lasting impressions of this case and the outcome earlier this week?
Well, I think, again, just very courageous of the family to speak coming out of court, because his sister was almost sick with grief. Like, I think his mum said, we got justice today. And so for them, that is, you know, it was a relief, but it's also, they have to, this isn't the end for them. They have to spend the rest of their lives this way. And that's heartbreaking. It's just a tragedy. And it's so senseless. It's just so sad to see a waste of life this way. And, you know, we heard all about Du Peruzzle's upbringing, and he was violent at school, and, you know, he's done this, he's done that, and in the end he likes being a bikie for the camaraderie and loyalty. And it's so sad. I remember I've spoken for another story to a former bikie who since left, and I said, why do people join? And he said, because they're lonely. And that is, you know, Du Peruzzle, that kind of sums it up. You know, he liked the camaraderie, the loyalty. That's so sad. Like, there are other ways to find community. Yeah. It's just so senseless and so pointless.
Yeah. And 14 years, the minimum that Mr. Du Peruzzle will have to serve. Hearing the immediate reaction of Mr. Versace's sister after that sentence was handed down, she obviously felt that was not quite enough. I think that's fair to say. And it does seem quite low compared to other murder cases. But then when you go back to the explanation that I've just given, is that the judge accepted that he accepted the plea of guilty for murder on the basis that it had been carried out during another crime. That's quite a rare thing to happen in a murder case, because in most murder cases you have to have an intent to kill. But there is another route to guilty, which is where they got to here, and that was obviously what was going on behind the scenes. Reading between the lines, Mr. Duperrouzel never accepted that he went there with the intent to kill, even though, as I say, he had the mask, he had the gun, and he fired the bullets. Again, quite a rare legal outcome, quite a historically low minimum term to serve for murder. But at the end of the day, totally sad and totally pointless, because it was over, apparently, a measly $3,000.
And a couple of things for that. I think because we heard the statement of facts in the morning and then Justice Derrick adjourned until the afternoon. And I think I said to you in the media room, the statement of facts to me was so interesting. Like you said, it's rare. I haven't been in a murder sentencing in this situation. I said to you, it almost sounded like that, you know, he was describing manslaughter. Mm-hmm. But it's because of that sort of nuance in the law where, because he was committing another crime, this was considered murder. So it's one of those things that you have to get your head around and then explain that simply for the news. So I found that sort of an interesting, it was just one of those cases you have to listen really carefully and make sure you get every fact exactly right. But the other thing that I found that struck me about the 14-year minimum is that that's how old Mr. Bisacci's daughter is today. She's 14 years old. And so she could be 28. When he gets out of jail. And I just sit there and I think, oh God, like, you remember what you're like at 14 and how difficult it would be to navigate life without your father, you know, in any case. And then to have that sort of dread to know that the man who killed him is going to be coming out of jail. Like, for me, the saddest part about this story is, like you mentioned, secondary victims for his daughter, my heart breaks.
Yeah. Well, Cyan, thanks for joining us on Caught in the Act today. I've been threatening to get you on since we started, so finally achieved that little tick in the box, so thank you very much. And a little side motion, because Cyan, as we said this week, was representing Seven News Perth in a courtroom next to me. Today she's coming to us from Melbourne, having moved her life and her job. So I just want to thank you for your camaraderie, inclusiveness and loyalty in our working relationship over the past few years. I'm going to miss you, and I'm sure the viewers and listeners in Perth are going to miss you. So even though you're over there now, don't be a stranger to us over here.
Thank you so much, Tim. I will really miss you too and your camaraderie and loyalty. And I think this is a much more constructive way to find it.
Indeed. Couldn't agree more. And to all the listeners, don't be strangers either, please. Don't hesitate to get in touch, writing to us at courtintheact@wanews.com.au. Don't forget to like and subscribe. Tell your friends, tell your mum. We're doing some great work here, so it deserves to be listened to. And if you want to know what's going on in court, of course, don't get caught short. Get caught in the act instead. See you next week.